Welcome to Trillions. I'm Joel Weber.
And I'm Eric Balchunas.
Happy New Year, Eric.
Yeah, you too. Happy New Year.
I'm ready for 2021.
Me too.
You know, at the beginning of the year already, there's a lot of talk about bubbles, potentially. We've had, despite the pandemic and a really awful 2020, equities were way up. A lot of investors made a lot of money, and yet here we are already, and there's just this palpable tension over, can it last?
Yeah. I mean, people have been asking, can it last, 200% ago? So it's been a tough trade to bail early. And so, but it's a question that won't go away and keeps getting greater. And, you know, the poster child for this era and this sort of tech and growth moment that we're in is definitely ARK. You know, we had Kathy Wood on maybe a year ago. We interviewed her, and ARK is now taking in money hand over fist, and the performance just won't quit. And so when you see something go up that much, people start to wonder how long it can last. And when I tweet about ARK, one thing that people will say is, reminds me of the Janus 20. And the other thing that people will say about what's going on is that it reminds them more of the internet era of the late 90s than it does, say, 2008. You know, that this is more of a techie, growthy kind of upswing rather than 2008's correction. So I thought, well, let's see if we can get the manager of the Janus 20, who was managing money at the fund in the late 90s, to basically, talk about whether that comparison is fair and see what he thinks of it all. And let me just give you some numbers on Janus 20. This is a fund, if you don't know, was really the big fund of its era. It went up 544% between 94 and 99. That's about, 5-6 years? That's exactly what Kathy is up right now after 6 years. It got to $35 billion. That's exactly what Kathy Wood's fund has. Although Janus stopped taking in cash, Kathy might have to, it might get bigger. But then it fell 50% in 2000, 2001 when the bubble burst. But then it went up another 100% up until 2007. So without further ado, we have the manager of that fund, Scott Schosel, who was the manager from 97 to 2007. And during that time, he was Mutual Fund Magazine's Manager of the Year and honorable mention for Morningstar for the same award in 2007. And there's a great headline. This just tells you how big of a deal this guy was. There was a great headline from the Denver Post when he left Janus 20 in 2007. Like Elway, Schosel leaves on top. And so, it's a long time ago. It seems like a whole nother lifetime. But it wasn't that long ago. And, history does have a good habit of rhyming. So I'm really excited to talk to him about how he sees what's going on today and some of his experiences back then.
Me too. And he's going to join us from Denver, Colorado. This time on Trillions, is ARK the new Janus 20? Scott, welcome to Trillions.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the trip down memory lane.
Yeah, I like the part where Eric said, that you left, and you left on the high part, right? So what are you doing now?
Well, I'm basically managing money for our family, running a family office, and focused on our foundation. Spent a lot of time with my kids as they navigated high school and into college and now out of graduate school. But I'm very active in the markets every day. I still have a cadre of former Janus analysts and portfolio managers I stay very close with. I just was on the phone for a half an hour this morning with a friend of mine who used to work with Paul Tudor Jones. So I stay pretty connected to the markets. I've never considered it a job. It's a lifelong hobby.
And I understand that you also have a farm in downtown Denver.
Well, I live on, a lot of people call it the farm. It's just outside of Denver. It's about 10 minutes away from 10, 12 minutes away from downtown Denver. It's in kind of a rural area. And we actually have a working barn and hay fields that we cut hay in and real live horses. I've been known to muck stalls from time to time when I'm in the doghouse with my wife. It's a little oasis in the city.
I am kind of jealous. I am in Philly, and I keep dreaming about a country life. Maybe I'm you're my model. I'm going to get to where you are someday. But anyway, until then, let's talk a little bit about ARK. You keep up with the market. You follow this. How do you see this fund in particular, Cathie Wood, ARK? Let's just start with your views on that. You know, do you see her as really echoing what you did at Janus 20 at the time?
Well, I am supremely impressed with the way she has structured her firm, her willingness to invest with a point of view, the way that she's been able to successfully leverage social media to augment the research process. She first hit my radar screen probably 18 to 24 months ago, and I've been watching. And I got to say, I'm very impressed. I think her analysts are doing a good job. I think she's got a great view of the future. And if I were gonna go back into the business and start a firm, she has created a fantastic template. There's many similarities between the Janus 20 Fund and ARK for sure. We were very research centric. We had a group of extraordinary analysts, many of which I'm still in contact with today, that were really focused on trying to invest in the future. And like everything, over time, things get better. And I think she's done a very, very good job of extending a lot of the things we were doing at Janus back in the late 90s and 2000s.
So there's the idea of being concentrated. You know, we on the show talk about these high active share funds being like hot sauce you put on top of maybe a lower cost, cheap beta portfolio. And she's certainly done that. And that's what the Janus 20 did. And your ramps up, I mean, when you look at a chart of the Janus 20 versus the S&P or Cathie versus the S&P, it looks like the Swiss Alps sort of towering above like flat farmland. And the thing
not
is, though,
not unlike what's around Denver, actually.
Yeah, it looks like Denver versus Philly. There you go. But in the Janus case, what you also live for was a correction. And I think that's what keeps coming up more and more when I tweet about Cathie. They're like, well, this could be tough. You know, you go up that high, you come down quick. Can you walk us through the sort of that moment, I guess, when the internet bubble burst and looks like it was 99 and then
late 99.
Yeah, it lasted about 2 years. How did that play out? Obviously, if you have less stocks, it can hurt you more. How did investors react?
Well, there's a lot of unpacking that needs to happen there. We decided to, it was not lost on me that there was money literally coming in over the transom. And while ARK is receiving a lot of money today, to just put that in context, late 99, Janus was receiving 70 cents of every dollar that was going into the mutual fund business. Think about that. 70 cents of every dollar going into the entire industry.
Wow.
Was going into Janus.
That's kind of what like Vanguard's doing that ish today. But yeah, that's a great stat. It gives you an idea of how big that firm was
the
in
magnitude.
The 90s. Yeah,
exactly. So it was not lost on me that valuations were getting rich. It was not lost on me that there was just so much money coming in. And so I remember in April of 99, which is kind of at the really at the height, I went to Tom Bailey, the founder of Janus, and said, you know, I think the best thing to do for the investors is to close the fund. And he looked at me and he said, as we were walking down the hallway, he said, great, let's close it. And he goes, let's close it on Friday. And this was a Tuesday. So that's one of the other things I loved about Janus is we were able to make very decisive decisions with very little bureaucracy. So we closed the fund in April of 1999. And it wasn't until kind of September, October, November that things started to kind of come unwound. And then obviously 2000 and 2001. I think, and my style of investing and my commitment to investing is much like Kathy's today, is that it never wavered. Even in 2000 and 2001, when things were selling off, we were still trying to invest in companies that we thought could capture the future. And if you look at the returns, the investors that had, and I think this is where, if I were Kathy and the media broadly, I would try to educate her investors to stay with it. I think she's really on to something, but there will be a period of time, maybe through her own doing or through some macro events in the marketplace, where the markets are going to sell off pretty dramatically. And if I were encouraging people to invest in her fund, I would say make sure that you have got the mindset to when that fund is down 30% or 40%, which it could be, that's when you want to step back in and recommit to the fund. Because if you would, I went back and looked, re-architected, you know, the investors that had the best performance in the Janus 20 fund, it's the guys that continue to invest either through a dollar cost averaging mechanism or just an active decision to buy it when they were down, believing that, hey, we had a process that, you know, we didn't immediately become, you know, 30% less intelligent because the fund was down, that we stayed with it, we stuck to our knitting. And I think that a lot of there needs to be a lot of education to her shareholder base that, hey, the future from A to B is not a straight line, and to be able to have the gumption to step in when this thing trades off from time to time.
So Scott, one difference with Kathy and ARK is that, you know, she's unable to close because it's an ETF, whereas you had a mutual fund. So talk about that difference and what advice you'd have on that side of the question.
You know, that's a very good observation, and I don't know what the answer is. We closed Janus 20 and to existing investors in April of 99. We had another side fund that was run alongside it, the Janus 40 fund. But between the two, you know, they had about $40 to $50 billion in assets, and I really felt that at that time, given the depth of the markets and liquidity and the market capitalizations of the company, I really felt that, you know, that was kind of the top end. And I think the markets are deeper. Her portfolio, her group of portfolio offerings is wider. I think she has six or seven funds as opposed to two. So I think that is probably the one thing that she is going to have to figure out a way to navigate is size. And I don't know if it's $50 billion is a number, or 75 or 100 or 150, but there will be a point where size will become kind of her enemy.
So I want to actually just step back and compare the moment that you lived through back then with this moment. How do you feel about it now? You're an investor, you're still in the markets with your family office. How do you feel about what where we are now versus then?
Well, certainly, you know, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. I think it's very easy to point to some of these valuations that are kind of head scratching using traditional yardsticks. But if you look at some of the total addressable markets that a lot of these high value companies are trying to address, you know, there's still a lot of headroom in the opportunity. I think we're just scratching the surface in some of this DNA sequencing, cloud computing and big data. I think we're still early days there. So I think that she's on to, you know, four or five broad trends. And I think she has 13 or 14 technologies that sort of embody that. So I think we're, and then with COVID, this whole digitalization phenomenon has been pulled forward. So I've talked to a bunch of CEOs and they said, yeah, we're operating today where we thought we would be 4 or 5 years ago. And so then you've got this whole generation of computer literacy. My kids are much more adept than I am at using some of these technologies. So you've got the convergence of lots of very bullish long-term macro factors. But it won't be a straight line. All of a sudden, you know, we've got a democratically controlled government, and you know, there's a regulatory regime that's going to be thought about a lot differently than it was yesterday. You've got financial markets, you know, got the 10-year is now robustly through 1%, which I don't think is in and of itself a problem. But what happens if it goes to 1.5 or 2? And how does that math re-engineer itself in terms of valuation? So there can be a lot of things that happen on a macro level that could compress these valuations, which is why I think that if I were giving advice to people broadly in the marketplace, it would be, if you, and you're investing in concentrated funds that are investing in the future that have had these huge runs, just be prepared. Don't get shaken out if the fund is down 30%. That's when you want to buy more. And if I look back at the Janus 20 fund, the people that had the best returns are the people that stepped in when the fund was down 25 or 30%. And I was being called, you know, an idiot, the village idiot, which I'm good with. I've been called worse. That's when you really want to step up. So you want to size the position going in and give yourself some, you know, margin of safety so that when opportunities present themselves, to be able to step in and buy more.
And, you know, when you talk to Kathy and see her online crowdsourcing research, she's got a young group of analysts. It really looks like she's having a good time doing this too. And I want to maybe compare her stock picking process to yours. And obviously, this is what none of the rest of the ETF industry can discuss, because they're all rules-based indexes that are, once you design them, it's over. Right. Talk about this stock picking process and maybe how much of the success is picking those stocks being concentrated or just having a hot hand, and how that all kind of comes together.
Right. One of the things I think that to be successful running a concentrated fund, you really have to invest with a point of view and have strong convictions. And I never had any interest in investing in my 57th favorite idea. And I remember one time, and so people you saw ask me all the time, how do I get a name into the Janus 20 fund? And I said, it's very simple. I said, during the course of the year, you'll be traveling around the country, meeting with management teams or seeing a product, or there will be something that crystallizes in your mind that this is a fantastic investment. And I said, I don't care if it is Christmas Eve, I don't care if it's my birthday, I don't care if it's Easter Sunday, whatever. Pick up the phone, email me, whatever, and get my attention. And so I remember very specifically, a young analyst was walking with me down the hallway, and he says, I've got it. I've seen a company that I think it fits the Janus 20 fund criteria, that threshold. I said, great. So as we walked from the fifth floor to the sixth floor, he described the company, what it was doing, and it reminded me of a company actually from about 10 or 15 years earlier. And by the time we got to the sixth floor, which took us, I don't know, 25 seconds, I said, we're going to own 10% of this company as fast as we can buy the shares. And one of the criteria I said that I used to some of the younger analysts, I would say, okay, how much of your bonus are we going to put into this fund? How convicted are you in this idea? And this kid gave me one of the great answers of all time. And he said, 200%. Think about
that's
that.
That's great.
So we knew we were paying him X.
Yeah, that's great.
So he basically, we ended up paying him 200X.
That's a twofer. He gets more money in his bonus.
Twofer.
And he gets the stock in the portfolio.
And one of the great stocks, and what pretty is brilliant. Still one of the great stocks after 15 years, and that's Intuitive Surgical. So this was Intuitive Surgical. If you reverse engineer the splits, et cetera, the car cost basis in this would be low single digit. So that to me was the threshold is having the conviction. You know, if you kind of reverse engineer the S&P 500 over the years, it's about 7% of the names that provide most of the outperformance. So I always felt that if we could find those names, and with our research capability and the judgment of the people at the shop and some luck. Luck pays a plays a, a luck. The more honest you are, the more real, the more you realize that luck does play a key role. But I would like to think that we had some pretty good judgment and being able to, Eric, we talked the other day about really spending time trying to understand the fabric of the company, not just the X's and O's of the balance sheet and the income statement, but really understand the real fabric. Is this a management team that can continue to grow and continue to capture the opportunity that's in front of them? And so we really, I think we did a good job, and I think Kathy is doing a good job of making those judgments, because at the end of the day, that's what it comes down to, is judgment.
Now, you talked about not wanting to buy the 57th best idea you had, or, you know, as you go down the list, it's nice to have just your best ideas. A lot of funds, I really can't do that. Like, and there's a lot of active funds who I know for a fact are sort of watching Kathy and all her success, and they're probably getting a little jealous or wondering how they can fit into the new world, especially as the $500 billion leaves active mutual funds last year. It's a steady drumbeat of outflows, especially on the equity side. What are your thoughts on the legacy active and that traditional more closet indexing active, and how it can sort of evolve into the future as passive becomes bigger? And then on the other side, you've got this barbell where the high active share gets success, but the middle seems like a tough spot to be.
The middle is always a tough spot to be. You know, I don't know really. I think that a lot of the mutual fund companies, if I were looking at them critically across the actively, I think they have too many funds. I think they have way too many funds. You know, I don't know how, and this is not, you know, if you look at T. Rowe Price or Fidelity, 50, 60, 70, 80 funds. I mean, that's a lot of actively managed. And I don't think there's 50, 60, 70, 80, you know, talented managers. I think that there's 7,500 managers in the 7,500 mutual funds, actively traded mutual funds in the country. There are not 7,500 good portfolio managers. There are, I mean, to my way of thinking, there's a dozen. But there are, you know, let's say it's 100. Okay. So if I were running some of these big actively managed fund complexes, I would start combining funds and make it simpler for the consumer to understand. And then in terms of concentration, I think it takes a special sort of DNA to run a concentrated fund. So one of the things that we were very good at Janus is being able to match people with their natural investment style with the fund that they were responsible to run. So the people that we had running our biotech funds, et cetera, they were not only had extraordinary academic backgrounds, et cetera, they were passionate about biotech. You know, I'm managing money today exactly the way I managed money in the Janus 20 fund. When I ran the 20 fund, I had 98% of my assets, my investable assets in the fund. I ran it exactly the way I would run my own money. So to me, if I were running an actively traded mutual fund shop, I would try to narrow the number of offerings, make them simpler to understand, and I would try to really do a good job of matching people into those funds that have a natural inclination to whatever the criteria of that fund is, and invest. And then from there, they'll end up investing naturally with a very convicted point of view, because you've got everything kind of lined up. I think that it's become more of a little bit of a marketing game when you have 83 different funds or 106 different funds. That to me doesn't make as much sense.
So as a former actively managing mutual fund guy, like when you look at the ETF, do you think it's a better vehicle?
Well, I think it depends. I mean, yes and no. So I do think that the ETFs are obviously much more tax efficient. 85, you know, some number, you guys know this better than I do, 80 or 85% of the active managers can't beat the index. And the indexes are not static. I mean, the S&P 500, everybody thinks, okay, it's the S&P 500, but it's a lot different than the S&P 500 2 years ago, 4 years ago, 10 years ago. So it's very subtly actively managed. So I think between, which is why it's tough to beat. But I think, I do think the way to beat the S&P 500 or your benchmark is to invest with a point of view, be able to size positions material above, quote, the benchmark. And if you're right, you know, you can outperform the markets over a long arc of time. But I think that that's a very, it's like I was saying to Eric the other day, it's kind of like professional golf. There's a lot of golfers out there. Okay. But there's 10, 12, 15, 20, 25 that are really the elite players. And I think the mutual fund business, the actively traded mutual fund business is very, very similar. So if you can buy par, the number of people that can shoot par in this country is what, 5%, 3%? So if you can buy par, okay, that's a good foundation. And then if I can go find the Dustin Johnson or the Rory McIlroy or the Tiger Woods of the actively traded mutual fund business, that's probably not a bad way to complement par.
Scott, when it comes to picking active and analyzing active, how important is it that the manager invest in their own funds? Did you do that at Janus 20?
I think it is absolutely critical that you invest in your own fund. The level of acuity that you have when you have ownership is a whole lot different. You know, one of the things, Peter Lynch used to have a very large, you know, his portfolios used to be very large, you know, 1500 stocks, et cetera, et cetera. But if you really drill down, most of his outperformance was in those top 15, 20, 25 names. But he has said that the reason he owns such a broad level of stocks is because once you own 5,000 shares or 10,000 shares of a particular stock, your level of acuity goes up 20x than if you're just kind of looking and following the price on paper. And so you amplify that. If you're running a fund and you have 80 or 90% of your net worth in that fund, trust me, it is, it has your undivided attention 24/7, 365. Now, I get that there are some highly specialized actively traded funds that are very narrow in focus, and that it may not make sense prudently to have that level of ownership in the fund. But to me, the baseline is if your portfolio manager, whoever it is, doesn't have 50% of their assets in the fund they're running, move on.
So I got to ask about another sort of elephant in the room, or at least last year, and I expect it to be true this year, which is the Fed. The Fed was just, you know, Jerome Powell was basically, we've called him Superman on the show before. What they were able to do last year was basically, you know, keep the markets on the table, and then actually probably helped put a fair amount of confidence into the system. So I'm just wondering, Scott, as you kind of look back at what you witnessed in the Greenspan era and then what we're seeing from Powell right now, what are your thoughts? How are we supposed to kind of evaluate the Fed, and what do you think, what do you expect as an investor?
Well, I think great question. I think that Jerome Powell's done a brilliant job. He's been unwavering, he's been decisive, and he's been consistent. The Greenspan era, you know, everybody used to, you know, there was so much Greenspan speak at the time, you couldn't, you know, what is he really saying? And is he carrying a big briefcase or a small briefcase? I mean, there used to be 20 minutes dedicated to on CNBC and Bloomberg as to, you know, what's his briefcase look like this? You know, what's he going to say? And what's that really mean? Jerome Powell's taken that off the table, and he's been very decisive at a critical time, you know, back in March in particular, March and April. So I think what the Fed has done, and the reason I'm still bullish on financial assets broadly, is that I think Buffett is correct. There are three asset classes that most normal people can invest in: stocks, bonds, real estate. Okay, let's think about that. The bond market until today has been giving you nothing. The 10-year has been at 0.66, okay, 0.72. It's now climbed a little bit over 1%. Okay, so you can pack away money for 10 years risk-free at 1%. You know, yahoo, okay? Let's look at the real estate market. The real estate market is really four different markets. There's commercial office space, probably not in a hurry to invest a lot of money in commercial office space. There's retail. Okay. The retail will be around 100 years from now, but I think we're over retailed. We were over retailed before Jeff Bezos was born. Then you've got industrial space. Okay, last mile. Okay, that looks pretty interesting to me. And you've got residential of all shapes and sizes. So of the four sectors in the real estate business, two are really not that interesting to me, and two are doing very robustly. So you've got bonds, not too exciting, half of the real estate market. Then you've got the equity market. Okay, and you've got the Fed pushing a ton of money into the system. So to me, I think, you know, the Fed, and I've been saying this for a while, the Fed has been forcing people into the stock market. And I don't expect that to change anytime soon. Now, and I've been telling people, watch the 10-year. The 10-year is where it all happens. And if all of a sudden the 10-year starts to trade 150, 175, 200, and depending on how it gets there, if it's kind of a slow walk up, or if it's all of a sudden, oh my God, you know, stop the printing presses, you know, we've kind of hit saturation. People aren't going to take, you know, 1.5% or 2 or 3% for corporate bonds. They want more and more and more. Then that's a paradigm shift. But for the last number of years, and I still think today, it's, you know, there's a pretty good tailwind to go into financial assets.
I just want to follow up real quick, though, but I think some people wonder if that does happen and you see equities really get a hit, that the Fed would fix it again, and that maybe equities will just never see the kind of correction you saw, where when the market went down that 50% during those 2 years, was there any thought the Fed would just come in and just, you know, bail you out as an equity investor?
No.
Equity investors assume that now. Like, you know, the Fed put, it's like an assumption, like,
yes.
Yeah. So is that a pretty big difference? Does that actually create a little
that
too much confidence?
That is a very big difference.
Yeah.
And it worries me at the highest levels. It worries me that the markets are more and more dependent on fiscal and monetary stimulus. I mean, how much time did we all, you know, kind of hang on the edge of our seats the last 6 months, waiting for that second stimulus package from Congress? That does worry me, that in order to sustain these markets, it's an addiction. You're addicted to either fiscal or monetary stimulus. Now, with the Dems running three branches of government, you know, I think that the fiscal stimulus will certainly be there. Now, does that start to crowd out the monetary, you know, the stimulus? You've printed so much money, the dollar gets whacked. But I agree with your nervousness about the increased need for fiscal and monetary stimulus to sustain these markets. That is a worry.
Is there anything that we didn't ask you that you want to make sure that we discuss?
No, not really. I mean, you guys are obviously very, very, very well versed in this. And you know, the ETF phenomenon, I was talking to Chuck Schwab not long ago, and I asked him what he thought, you know, where are we in this? And, you know, even though it would be talking his own book to say, hey, we're in early days of moving to ETFs, et cetera, I mean, he's really a very, I know him well enough that he's not trying to sell me on anything. And he just feels as though that we're still early days, you know, that we're still early days in this move into different flavors of ETFs, et cetera. Because like today's a perfect example. A lot of the people that have been investing in a lot of these tech stocks and biotech stocks that have been up and to the right, well, they don't have the time or don't have the expertise to be able to differentiate between JP Morgan, Citigroup, Wells Fargo, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley. And the financials are sort of on fire. So the easiest thing to do is just to go buy the XLF. So they serve a very, very, very real purpose. And I think that, Eric, to your point earlier, I think that a good way to construct a portfolio is with a baseline of ETFs, maybe some actively managed funds, but more ETFs, and then augment that with people, with the golfers that can really, exert a point of view and have the infrastructure at the firm they're that's actually one thing that we didn't talk about, is that after 98, 99, and certainly after 08, a lot of these big firms, a lot of mutual fund complexes of all sizes actually, have become so risk averse that in order, and concentrated funds are looked at as risky. I personally believe they're less risky, but be that as it may, to be able to find a fund complex that has culturally the ability to let a talented manager invest with that point of view and take some reputational risk at the firm, that's a rare, a more rare and rare breed. One of the things I like about Kathy's fund is that it's all one thing. It's not, they don't have 85 different funds trying to satisfy, 85 different appetites. They have six or seven funds that are trying to satisfy sort of one appetite. If I were looking at trying to find a concentrated, actively managed fund, I would also, my things on the checklist would be able to find a fund family that is willing to risk some reputational capital to allow and create an environment for a portfolio manager who's willing to invest with a point of view, the latitude, because there will be some volatility. But if you have the ability to stay with it over a long arc of time and they're good at it, you found the Dustin Johnson, the Rory McIlroy, the Tiger Woods, it can be very, very, very rewarding.
So last question for you. Here we are at the beginning of 2021. I'm just wondering, as a professional investor of sorts with your family office, how much risk are you willing to take right now?
I'm about 94% invested, which the big portfolio has 8 stocks in it. The most aggressive portfolio has 2. So I'm a believer. I like the companies I own. I like the management teams that I own. I like the total addressable markets. I'm willing to live with a different level of volatility than maybe some investors. But I'm an optimist. I think the future looks bright, and there's more opportunity in front of us than there is behind us.
Boom. If you got a second with Kathy Wood, what advice would you have for her?
Advice. Wow. I would frame it a little bit differently. I would just be encouraging. I'm in no position to give anybody in her position advice. I would simply give her encouragement and I would just encourage her to educate her shareholder base, which she does a great job of. I mean, she sends out all those materials about on their research and the crowdsourcing of the research. I mean, she does a really good job at that. And there hasn't been a big drawdown there yet. I would be encouraging.
Perfect.
And size. Size is the only thing that, and I don't have an answer for that. So I don't have advice to give her, but I would just simply be encouraging. That's what Tom Bailey was to me when I ran the 20 fund. And, he was we're getting way off in the weeds on stuff, but I believe that in order to have a successful mutual fund company, you have the person who runs the company has to come from portfolio management. Okay. Look at Fidelity. Fidelity was run by portfolio managers. For a period of time there, though, it was run by a lawyer and they really struggled. And then, now, and Abby used to run funds, et cetera, et cetera. So they're back on track. Look at Microsoft. The person at the top of the firm has to be from the DNA of that firm. you know, Bill Gates was a software engineer. Steve Ballmer was a marketing guy. The stock traded flat for 14 years. You bring in Satya and all of a sudden the stock's up, you know, 12X. It's so true in the mutual fund business that the people that are at the top of that are running the business have to come from the DNA of the business, because, and that's the thing that why I loved working for Tom Bailey, is because he was a portfolio manager. He knew that there were going to be, you know, bumps in the road, and his advice, he never gave advice. He just gave encouragement. And that was so reassuring, because you start to second guess yourself. You know, you start to, there's so many things, your head just starts to explode when things start to move against you. But he was so encouraging. And so if I were, my thing to Kathy Wood would not be advice. It would just be encouragement.
Perfect. All right, Scott, I wish you a healthy and happy 2021, okay?
Thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for your time. You're fantastic.
Thanks for listening to Trillions. Until next time, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal, Bloomberg.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you like to listen. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter. I'm at Joel Weber Show. He's at Eric Balchunas. This episode of Trillions was produced by Magnus Hendrickson. Francesca Levy is the head of Bloomberg Podcasts. Bye.